one remains fixated on the Nazi period. There's so much about it that we still don't properly understand. In the German language, Schrecklichkeit really is what characterizes the Hitlerzeit. How, Brian, do we translate Schrecklichkeit?
Horrible, terrible.
Just a time of horror, and yet at a time of irrationality, yet most of the society participated, including, this is what we discover in your new book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, including many Jews, most of them what in German are called Mischlinge, that is, partial Jews, half Jews, quarter Jews.
It's a horrible term, and it, you know, literal translation means bastard, mutt, hybrid, and the Nazis used this term to, you know, identify half Jews and quarter Jews.
Well, the verb mission is essentially to mix, isn't it?
Yeah, but they actually, it's a term that has to use, the Nazis used that came out of, you know, identifying mutts, dogs. You know, it just shows you what type of connotation was behind this term.
I'm sorry you're going to get into this. I haven't fully identified my guest. Brian Mark Rigg got his bachelor's degree from Yale, went over to Cambridge, and did a master's and a doctorate, all in history, and was on the continent in Germany on and off over many years in interrogating, getting to know survivors of the German Wehrmacht, all of whom had one thing in common, and that thing was?
They were of Jewish descent and, you know, served as soldiers in the German military during World War II.
And that investigation is reported in a masterly work that has just recently been published. It's titled Hitler's Jewish Soldiers: The Untold Story of Nazi Racial Laws and Men of Jewish Descent in the German Military. The first and immediate question is, if the Nazi regime was so anti-Semitic and excluded Jews from all aspects of common public life and civic culture, as they did, then how did these guys wind up in the army rather than restricted off into ghettoized private dwelling? I know they didn't kill all the German Jews right away. They got around to it towards the end of the war, in fact. They killed the Eastern Jews much more readily than they killed the German Jews. But how did these guys get into the army?
Well, the story of the Mischlinge shows us just how complex the Nazi racial regime was. And the society wasn't split up nicely as Hitler, you know, wanted it to be between Aryans and Jews. And suddenly when he started implementing these, you know, racial laws on society, he found that there were hundreds of thousands of people in Germany who considered themselves Christians and Germans, and now it was no longer a religious question, it was a racial question, and suddenly they found themselves being half Jews and quarter Jews.
Don't you think that if one really had all the available data, and that's probably lost and can't be recovered, if you could really track the genealogies of the Germans who were alive in the Hitler period, that it might not be hundreds of thousands who had some Jewish genetic contribution to their makeup, but probably millions.
I would assume that there were, the number was much larger than the Jewish population at the time. You know, the when we're saying half Jews and quarter Jews and full Jews, these are all Nazi terms, and so this is, you know, within the context of the history when I use these terms. But the full Jewish population was 600,000, and I believe that the quote-unquote Mischlinge population was twice as large, if not larger.
Or even larger, because for 100 years in German-speaking Europe, in Austria and Germany, Jews had been very assimilationist. Many of them had eagerly married non-Jews and thrown their Jewishness away. Karl Marx, who is in the early, born in the early 19th century, was born of two fully Jewish parents. He's a descendant of rabbis, and his father converted and converted Karl, or rather baptized Karl, right after his birth.
That's correct. Yeah, and this, especially after the War of Independence in 1812, and then after the unification of Germany under Bismarck, there was a mass rush with emancipation to convert, you know, change your name to a more German-sounding name, to assimilate. A lot of times aristocratic families married into Jewish families. The Jewish family got the name, the status, and the aristocratic family, usually that were poor,
they got the money.
Yeah, because a lot of the Jewish families were very powerful banker families.
Before we get into this in more systematic detail, an excellent illustration of all of this is that a great Jewish figure, indeed a great Jewish philosopher, is Moses Mendelssohn. You discover that there are dozens of descendants of Moses Mendelssohn who are serving in the German Wehrmacht.
Yes, you know, Moses Mendelssohn, one of the greatest Jewish German, if not the greatest German Jewish philosopher, who promoted the Haskalah, the Jewish German Enlightenment. He promoted assimilation. But he didn't want his descendants to actually convert to Christianity
Just
and
wanted them to
marry. Yeah, he
modernize.
wanted to modernize. But that actually is what happened. I think four out of his six children all married non-Jews. And by the time we get to the Third Reich, I've been able to document that 46 people who can trace their lineage straight to Moses Mendelssohn actually served in the German military. And, you know, one gentleman, Franz Mendelssohn, he was a captain in the Navy, and he built U-boats. And his name was Mendelssohn. And they couldn't prove exactly with his genealogy where the Jewishness came from, although the name should have been a dead giveaway. And he served the entire war.
Let's do a quick roster of some of the eminent Nazi military or German military who were, in fact, half Jews. The foremost among them, I guess, is Field Marshal Milch, wouldn't you say?
Yes, Field Marshal Milch. He was State Secretary of Aviation, and he became a powerful Field Marshal during the Third Reich. A Field Marshal is equivalent of a five-star general. And he ran the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, and was its most powerful figure per personnel, planning, production, and strategy. And his greatest contribution to the Luftwaffe was to organize the massive program of aerial rearmament begun in 1933. And by 1936, under Milch's leadership, the German air industry had become a first-rate organization.
He built the German Air Force.
Yeah, he was the
so
power.
The man who fronted for it was Göring.
Göring, yeah, but he could not organize it at all. He needed Milch. And then another very influential person in the Luftwaffe was Helmut Wilberg. And he was an extremely brilliant man and a first-rate commander who helped lay the foundation for the Luftwaffe's operational concept, today known as Blitzkrieg. During World War I, he was the first air commander to organize and employ whole air groups in the ground support role. And after the war, he was handpicked to be the aviation commander of the secret Luftwaffe. And in 1935, when the Luftwaffe came into being, he prepared the manual which served as the Luftwaffe's primary expression of battle doctrine in World War II. Now, he was the logical choice to command the Luftwaffe, but owing to party politics, it was given to Göring, and everybody knew that he was a half-Jew, and that's why he was out, basically pushed off to the side, although they used his mind.
And when they come to Göring and complain, and some do, and say, I guess doctrinaire Nazis, and say, your guy Milch is a Jew, Göring's famous answer is, wer Jude ist, bestimme ich.
Yeah, who is not a Jew, I will decide, he said. But if he wanted to officially Aryanize somebody, is the Nazi term, Aryanize, he actually had to bring the case to Hitler, and Hitler would then look at the photographs and the application of the person, and then on the basis of that, he would say, okay, here's your kosher stamp of approval of Aryanhood.
And that's called a Deutsch Blutigkeitserklärung.
Yeah, German blood declaration.
Incredible.
Absurd. But
signed
Hitler,
by Hitler.
Yeah,
after he studies pictures and thinks about it and broods on it for a month or two, he decides who he will allow to be a full-blooded German and who he will not.
That's correct. And Wilberg and Milch were two of these people that got Aryan declarations, or the Deutsche Blutigkeitserklärungen.
And there's yet others. There's a man who's very high in the Navy. What is he, the adjutant to the commander of the Bismarck?
Oh, yeah, the first officer on the Bismarck, Paul Asher.
Yeah.
And Hitler looked at photographs from him and within a few hours actually decided on his case. And he was a half-Jew. And he went down with the Bismarck, fighting to the very last.
When the British said sink the Bismarck, they sunk Asher as well.
Exactly. He went right down next to Lutyens. Actually, Lutyens, who was the fleet commander, was married to a half-Jew, Bakenkohler. And her brother was a high-ranking, I think he was a vice admiral. And he was a high-ranking admiral during the Third Reich, and he was a half-Jew.
We had a fair amount of that around, didn't you, as well? That is, full non-Jews, full Aryans, so-called, and high in the military, who were married to Jewish women, or half-Jewish women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had quite a few of individuals who were, quote-unquote, Aryans, like the Nazis called them, but were married to Mischlinge, or Jewish women. And they would also have to get special exemptions from Hitler and the government to remain in service.
So what's going on here? There are two different psychological patterns that have to be explained. One is, what did the high Nazis really have in mind? Aren't they supposed to be deep anti-Semites who want to purge the Jewish presence in Germany? And the opposite question, of course, is, what was in the minds of these Mischlinge who aspired to not only serve in the German military, the Wehrmacht, but to have prominent military careers and to be fully identified, or almost fully identified, with the Nazi purpose, or at least the German nationalist purpose? Those questions are the ones that confront us, and we'll turn to them right after we pause for these words. And directly back to Brian Mark Rigg. We'll talk more about these Jewish members of the Wehrmacht, what happened to them, and for that matter, the particular ones that were interviewed by Brian Mark Rigg. How many of them did you get to talk to in all?
I talked to 430 families, and out of them, I think 260 of them were actual Wehrmacht veterans.
Yeah. And of course, you've followed many more in their careers through tremendous archival material that you've...
I've documented by name and rank 1,700 yeah. men.
But before we come to that, let me reinstate the question I was posing a moment ago. If the Germans, particularly the high Nazis, were really anti-Semitic and were racialist to the core, how could they have tolerated and how could they have drawn into the Wehrmacht or kept in the Wehrmacht officers and, for that matter, enlisted men who were half Jews, some of them even full Jews?
The full Jews always served with false documents. Now, the half Jews and the quarter Jews, according to the conscription laws of 1935, had to serve, and that's something that's crazy about this history. Now, what were the Nazis
thinking? You mean the German draft included them?
Yeah, the German draft included. They had to serve. They didn't have a choice. But what's interesting with the high-ranking Nazis, particularly Hitler, because he was basically the deciding factor for the for these
policies. And he was a racialist nut of ultimate power.
But he knew if he was too aggressive with the Mischlinge during the 30s and 40s, he might lose the support of thousands of Aryans who held key positions in the government, economy, and military, who were high-ranking personalities.
And many of them were related to half-Jews.
Exactly. And they had Mischling relatives. So if you persecute the Mischling relatives too much, you're going to tick off a lot of Aryan people who you need to run your regime. So for political considerations, Hitler was not as aggressive with these individuals. I mean, had Hitler won the war or prolonged it, half-Jews would have shared the fate of the full Jews. But in the 30s and 40s, when these men were serving, Hitler was allowing him to serve because of that. He didn't want to tick off the Aryan side of the families. Also, he possibly felt like he needed to field as many Germans as he could in the coming war. And from his experience in World War One, he knew how many men could be lost in one battle.
And there was some high talent there. Milch obviously had already made his contribution even before the Nazi period.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved in German aviation from even before they came to power. Then he was very important in helping to build the German, the Nazi Air Force. You wouldn't easily throw him away
Absolutely.
Because you needed him, particularly as you're going to war. But ordinary enlisted men.
Mm-hmm.
One would think that, quite apart from Hitler having an animus against all Jews, one would think that as Hitler and his bunch sold anti-Semitism and made it essentially a part of the Nazi religion, mm-hmm. and that this filtered down so that you generally had a very anti-Jewish feeling in Germany, mm-hmm. that this would have made life hell for the ordinary Jewish or half-Jewish enlisted man, that his commanding officer and his buddies would not have been buddies, but rather would have been enemies.
This is something that I was shocked about. Many of these men, when they were serving, they were thinking, hey, maybe my service will help protect my family. Maybe it will help, make me an equal citizen again. And that gave their service meaning. And also, many of the men tell me on countless occasions their comrades found out about their Jewish past, but they had proven themselves as loyal comrades, as proven soldiers, and they were accepted part of the fraternity. I mean, one crazy story that I experienced was in 1994, I just finished interviewing a gentleman, we'll call him Hamburger, and after the interview, his girlfriend came in and said, you should take the young American tonight. And he tried to hush her up very quickly, and she's like, no, you should take the young American. He would find it interesting. So I asked Herr Hamburger, what's going on tonight? And he said, well, I'm meeting a whole bunch of my veterans at a bar tonight. We talk about our lives and drink some beer. We do this mm-hmm. once a month. Would you like to go? I said, sure. So a few hours later, we were about to go to the bar, and he said, hey, before we go there, you got to promise me two things. First of all, you can't tell anybody that I'm of Jewish descent. For the last 60 years, I've kept this hidden, and I like to keep it that way. I was like, okay, Herr Hamburger, I won't tell anybody. He says, second of all, you can't tell them what you're researching, because then they'll wonder why you came and talked to me. I was like, okay, I'll tell them I'm researching the Wehrmacht. He's like, okay, that's good. So we walked into this bar, and there was about 40 veterans there. Many of them had brought documents. They were interested in meeting this young American. And for the first hour, I could tell that Hamburger was very nervous. He was basically latched onto my right shoulder as if I was going to jump up on the table and tell everybody that he was a half-Jew. But after an hour, he saw that I was being very discreet, and he left me to my own devices. And I started working my way around the table, and I eventually came into a conversation with the company commander who was still alive. And during our conversation, that he was telling me about his tactics, how he won his Medal of Honor in Russia, I asked him, during my research of the Wehrmacht, I've come across an interesting phenomenon about Jews and men of Jewish descent who served in the Nazi military. Have you ever heard about this? He looked at me in a very surprised way, spotted Hamburger in the other end of the room, and then said in a conspiratorial tone, don't tell Hamburger, but we know he's a Jew. I was like, oh, okay, I won't say anything. And what's interesting here, and this is an example of many guys, is that for Hamburger's comrades here, they had accepted him as part of the fraternity. He had proven himself as a soldier, as a loyal comrade, and he was one of the group. And a lot of times, many of the half-Jews knew that their comrades knew, and they still were not mistreated. And this was quite shocking.
Morris Janowitz, who did a major study of morale in the Wehrmacht. This was shortly after the war. Janowitz was a famous military sociologist, in fact, a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago for many years. And Janowitz's finding, Janowitz and Bettelheim did this work together, was that what really held the Wehrmacht together, what really kept them going, even in times of great adversity, was the buddy system within, at the company level. Mm-hmm. And that the most crucial person was the Feldwebel, the sergeant, who really knew how to make a group out of this bunch and keep them all loyal to one another.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about the primary group, but many of these men, they were drafted from the same village or the same, you know, part of the city. And so many of them had gone to school together with each other. So there was a history there. They didn't want to let each other down in combat. They knew that the families were all together, and you know, news spread very quickly. And also, when the laws got stricter in 1940 and 41 with half Jews, many of these units bonded together and helped you know, a half Jew apply for clemency. Because in 1940, several reports were reaching Hitler about half Jews who were coming home from you know, the battle fronts in Poland in 1939 and other battle fronts throughout Europe. And, you know, dad had lost his job, mom was being persecuted, and many of the, you know, granddad was being thrown in prison. And many of these soldiers went to their commanders and said, hey, look, I've served this country honorably, I have the Iron Cross, and look how my family's being treated. This is a disgrace. And to the credit of thousands of Aryan officers, they sent such complaints up the chain of command. And many of these stories reached Hitler, and Hitler decided in April of 1940 that they could no longer hold half-Jews in the military because of all the complications, because they couldn't protect full Jews. So he said, discharge the half-Jews. But he put in this discharge order that any half-Jew who had performed valiantly in battle was allowed to apply for clemency. And thousands of men did so. And usually you see that the whole company gets behind the guy and trying to help him, you know, get his documents, the company commander, the company sergeant writing recommendations. And that's also something that was very shocking.
How many of the Jews that you examined, whether you interviewed them or whether you looked at their records and reconstructed their lives, how many of them remained Judaic? That is, remained essentially loyal to Jewish identity and, for that matter, even to Judaism as a religion?
Oh, it's a minority. Now, the full Jews who I've documented, the vast majority of them, and there are about 100 men who I've been able to document by name and rank, I would say the vast majority of them remain culturally or you know, identified as Jews, culturally Jewish or, you know, religiously Jewish. From the so-called mischling of the half-Jews and the quarter-Jews, I would say probably 15, maybe 20% of the half-Jews and quarter-Jews who I've documented felt some attachment to Judaism. But after the war, because of the persecution a lot of them underwent, many of them feel even more Jewish today than they did back then because of the persecution.
But going back to that time, shifting from the Nazis who commanded them to the Jewish soldiers, whether officers or enlisted men, how did they reconcile the fact that they were serving what was the great anti-Semitic force in the world?
You know, many of them, the half-Jews and quarter-Jews, they had to serve. It was, you know, the conscription laws required them to serve, so they didn't have a choice. I mean, they could go to their superiors or go to the draft board and say, hey, I feel Jewish, I hate Hitler, and they not only put themselves in jeopardy, but their families.
Yeah.
Now, the full Jews who I've documented, that was their survival technique. They said, hey, you know, who could parade around being a Jew back then? No one. So I hid my, you know, identity, served in the military, and the safest place was in the mouth of the wolf.
But you found some who were loyal Nazis.
Yeah, there were a few people that were Nazi party members. Many of them did not know about their Jewish past.
Oh, they discovered it later.
Yeah. Or many of them were self-hating Jews, but they were very rare. Most of them did not know about their Jewish past, and it only came out when they started doing their ancestry booklets that they had a Jewish grandmother or a Jewish mother, but that their, you know, the relatives had converted, and they always thought it was a religious question, not a racial question. Suddenly with Hitler, it no longer mattered what religion your family had. It suddenly mattered what ethnicity they had, although they had to use religious criteria to define that, you know, race.
It was curiously two-sided, wasn't it, or rather it was unbalanced from one side to the other. If a Jew had converted to Christianity, he was still, by Nazi reckoning, a Jew.
That's correct.
Eternally a Jew. If a Christian converted to Judaism, as some did because they married a Jewish spouse and decided that that would be the way to do it, or that would please the parents or whatever, any Christian who converted to Judaism for the rest of his life, and it might be a short life, was counted as a Jew.
Yes, that's correct. If a Jew converted to Christianity, he was still a Jew. But if you were a Gentile and had converted to Judaism, Although the Nazis would say, well, we can't find any Jews in your family tree, but by the very fact that you converted to Judaism shows that you have Jewish blood and therefore you're polluted. And those people were sent off to the camps just like, you know, ethnic Jews.
Yeah. One thing that has to be made clear to our audience, at least, some may know a great deal about this period, many may not, is that the genocidal intention was activated as soon as the Germans crossed the line and invaded the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. In fact, they had been doing some killing in the German-controlled part of Poland even before they broke the Nazi-Soviet pact and invaded. Mm-hmm. But once they crossed the line, they really were hell-bent for getting rid of the Jews, mm-hmm. for making Europe Judenrein, mm-hmm. clean of Jews. Mm-hmm. But the general strategy that was followed, and Hitler certainly was in on this, initiated it, or agreed with his underlings that this is the way to do it, is that the Jews will kill last are the German Jews.
I'm sorry, what?
That the last Jews will kill are the German ones at home.
Yeah, they, you know, it was very easy to target the Polish Jews and the German Jews because then you're not dealing with a whole bunch of Aryan relatives in Germany.
And they're far away. People won't see them being killed either.
And also, there, you know, if you're dealing with half Jews and quarter Jews in the East, there are only half Slavs or, you know, 75% Slavs, so they're also bad on the other side. Whereas in Germany, if you're dealing with Mischlinge there, you're dealing with a half Jew, he's half bad, but you're dealing with a half German, he's half good, and you're dealing with that family too. So they were really in a very delicate situation here. And so, yeah, many of the Nazis said, we'll deal with this situation after the war. You know, nonetheless, many of the men who I've documented, while they were serving on the front lines, grandma, granddad, aunts and uncles, cousins were being sent off to Auschwitz. On average, every Mischling soldier who I have documented lost around 7 to 8 Jewish relatives in the Holocaust.
And you have some of them in uniform visiting the concentration camps and the extermination camps.
There were a few individuals who went to concentration camps, Dachau and Sachsenhausen. Sachsenhausen outside of Berlin, Dachau.
Didn't one go to Auschwitz as well?
I had a few, I've documented through some interviews of people saying that their relatives did go there to find, but then they were simply sent away. Whereas in Sachsenhausen, they were actually able to talk to the parent. There was another flip side.
A German officer walks in and comes to a Jewish prisoner and...
Yeah, his father.
And is identified by the father as my son.
Yes, yeah, and the commander there was totally shocked, according to the sources I have. He was a Panzer officer, so he had his black uniform, so he actually he looked like an SS officer. And he walked in, and he's like, I want to see my father. And the commander just, you know, is shocked. And then they eventually do come into a conversation, and the son says to his father, hey, if I continue to serve well, we might get an exemption. I might be able to save you. I might be able to save our family. And, yeah, so that's crazy. They went to the camps, you know, some of them. I also have documented that some half-Jews were sent to Auschwitz right from their units, and their mothers were able to come and visit them through the fences in Birkenau, according to an Auschwitz survivor who has sent me some documents, some letters about his experience.
Yeah, they were kicked out of the army and sent off to an extermination center.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Some of them even with medals, I imagine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's one man that I've documented because of racial defilement. He was sleeping with an Aryan woman. He was sent off to Auschwitz, and while he was waiting in line, he pulled out a picture of himself saying, now you will exterminate a Wehrmacht soldier. And they actually, there's a huge court case in Munich that happened after the war with this guy. And the SS guards did not feel comfortable exterminating a soldier, and they actually pulled him out of the line. And he survived the war remarkably. And his son, later on, converted to Judaism and went to Israel and served in the 56 war in the Sinai for Israel.
You come to an estimate that some 150,000...
That's correct.
Half Jews or Mischlinge, partial Jews by origin, served in the Wehrmacht. Wehrmacht, we should make clear, means all the armed forces.
Yeah, the German armed forces.
Not just the army, but German armed forces generally. How do you come to that estimate?
Looking at assimilation records, birth rates, and mixed marriage rates, as well as talking to a few statisticians and mathematicians, I conservatively estimate that 60,000 half-Jews and 90,000 quarter-Jews served in the German armed forces during World War II. Now, this is a small number compared to the total size of the Wehrmacht.
Mm-hmm.
By 1945, over 17 million men had gone through the ranks of the Wehrmacht, so this 150,000 Mischling soldiers represent a very small group compared to the total size. But nonetheless, in light of the Holocaust, this number is shocking.
What would your estimate be if you assume the 150,000 as the total number? What would your estimate be as to how many served at the officer level and how many at the enlisted level?
Oh, I would assume that, you know, according to, if you look at the 1,700 men who I have documented, there's probably about 300 or 400 of them who were officers. So, you're looking at several thousand, probably 10 or 15 thousand, I would estimate, but that's a rough estimation. I don't know, but several thousand.
How, in general, from what you've picked up in the interviews especially, how in general did they adapt to all of this if they survived the war and in all the years since then?
Well, many of them, the questions of identity really come up. Who am I? Am I a Jew? Am I German? Am I a victim or am I a perpetrator? Now that they know about what happened to their families, they feel a lot of guilt. But what were my choices? They use a phrase from Lawrence Longer. Many of them were dealt with choiceless choice. What else could I have done? And the survival instinct is very strong. So many of them, when they look back at their service, they will tell you that they don't feel guilty. But when you ask them, have you talked to your wives, or have you talked to your children or grandchildren about this? Most of them have said no. And some of them have told me, hey, my wife doesn't know about this, my kids don't know about this, I like to keep it quiet. So this is very revealing as far as the guilt and how they feel about it. But most of them, at least they'll tell you on a conscious level, hey, I don't feel guilty. I'm here today because of that.
There were specialists in the German military and in the army and the SS who were Jew killers. They were either in the Einsatzkommando units or in the Ordnungsbataillonen, or they served in the extermination camps.
That's correct.
Did you find evidence of any Jews doing that kind of service?
There were a few. There was one individual that after the war he claimed to be Jewish. Now, whether he was Jewish or not, a historian in Germany is now doing a lot of research on him, and he supposedly ran a camp outside of Riga during 42 and 43, and he was an SS officer. But by and large, most of the men who I've documented were not in the Death Head squads. They were not in the SS. They were not actively going out in Einsatzgruppen commandos and so on and killing Jews. There was a huge war going on. I mean, when Germany invaded Russia in 1941, 3.6 million men crossed a border 1,000 miles long, and most of them were in constant combat for 4 years. I think according to Browning, Christopher Browning, wonderful historian, one of his estimates is that around 50,000, 60,000 people were actively engaged in the killing process. So 50,000 compared to 3 million, it didn't take a lot of people.
But if you read Browning, and I have, and he's been on this program, in fact, in his book Ordinary Men, which traces the operations of an Ordnungsbataillon, that translates really as military police.
Yeah, police battalion.
But they pulled them from particular localities. The ones in his Ordnungsbataillon who went in and to villages and towns in Poland and rounded up all the Jews and killed them, usually by marching them out to the nearby forest, having them dig mass graves, and then shooting them down, and then bringing in the next batch. These guys in that particular battalion, it was Battalion 101 that he
One.
studied,
That's correct.
they all came from Bremen. If they come from a particular locality, you might, one would think, well, just by the ordinary distribution of Mischlinge in German life, in that battalion, one or two men might have been part
Yeah, you're
Jewish.
absolutely correct. And in Browning's book, he does document that in 42 and 43, there were laws implemented to kick out Mischlinge from the police battalions.
Yeah.
So there were,
And from all the army,
yeah,
in
and
fact.
because the laws were instigated, that means there were men in the police battalion. So yeah, there were people. I'm sure there were several people that were participants in the extermination process, the Holocaust. But most of the men who I've documented were, I have not been able to document that. And most men who I've interviewed, if they were, they did not admit it. And most of them from the service records that I've been able to get on them prove that they were not.
A great question, of course, since these men served, many of them, on the Western Front in the battle for France and so on, and up in Norway. But then comes the great invasion of the Soviet Union, and there are Jews distributed all over those army units as well.
Well, what's interesting here is that by the time that Germany invades Russia, I would say 50% or 60% of the half Jews who were in the service by 1918
I've been ordered out.
have been ordered out
Yeah.
because Hitler had issued this decree in April of 1940, 8th of April 1940. Now all half Jews serving in units that invaded Denmark and Norway on the 9th of April remained untouched because this discharge order never reached them. And the vast majority who would invade France 1 month later also remained untouched due to bureaucratic mishaps and the secrecy involved with the
Yeah,
invasion.
but you say in there that when it came to what commanders did, half of them or so just disregarded the order because they wanted to keep their Jews because
Exactly.
they were good soldiers.
That's
So there
correct.
would have been Jews on the Eastern Front as well.
Oh, yes. And many of them were drafted in 41 and 42, although it was against the laws at the time. But it was just so hard when you're, drafting millions of people to check all their family trees.
But that leads me then to the question. I pose this again just as we dash off for some commercial,
Sure.
so, but I want to leave this in your mind for a few minutes. What about those half-Jewish or quarter-Jewish, those Mischlinge soldiers in the Wehrmacht who are on the Eastern Front on into 42 and 43, or even by mid-41, and get wind of the extermination camps? Those extermination camps are essentially in occupied Poland. And also up in the Baltic countries. And there must have been some German Jewish soldiers around who got wind of all of this. How in the world could they go on fighting for the German state under those conditions? We return directly to Brian Mark Rigg, drawing from his very important new book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. By the way, that is published by University of Kansas Press. And we return after this. And we return to Brian Mark Rigg, drawing from his book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. And I'm imagining a Jewish soldier, a Mischling, probably half Jewish, on the Eastern Front, and he gets wind of what's happening at Auschwitz or at Treblinka or whatever. Maybe he even passes by, or at least he talks to other soldiers who've been there, and they tell him. They're killing people, and they're mostly Jews. And some of them are just Slavs, and some of them are Gypsies, but the largest number are Jews. And they're killing them, or they're working them to death. And maybe even tells them about the separation scene. You go to the left, you go to the right, you go to the gas chambers, you go to the factory when they just get off the trains. If a Jewish soldier out on the Eastern Front hears about that, how does it affect him? What does he do with it?
Well, many of the men who I've documented, they chose not to believe the signs that they were given. Many of them saw executions in the East if they were on the Eastern Front. But many of them thought, okay, those executions are for prisoners of war, are for partisans. Many of them did not think that those executions were strictly for Jews because these people were Jewish. Some of these, at least that's what they tell you. And also, many of them knew about concentration camps, and some of them had heard about death camps. Most of them will tell you they did not hear about Auschwitz until after the war.
Do you believe that? I mean, that's a general German line that you get from non-Jewish Germans.
Well, many of these men were losing relatives in Auschwitz.
Yeah,
and
that's
there was one soldier that he came home and there was a notification in the mailbox that his father had been sent to Auschwitz, and he tries to get there to visit his father. He didn't know what it was. And I think if he really knew what it was, he wouldn't have been trying to go there because he knew his father was already dead because his father was 75 or 76 at the time. I have another gentleman that he was taking gas to a Luftwaffe squadron in the Ukraine, and when he got out of the train at one stop, they saw a whole bunch of people being marched away, and so they started following them just to see what was going on, and an SS guard came up and said, "What are you doing here?" And they're like, "Well, we're wondering what these people are here for and where they're going." And they're like, "Oh, they're going to a camp called Auschwitz." And the guy said, "Well, what's Auschwitz?" "Oh, it's a camp, we hold prisoners and so on." And that was the extent of what he knew of Auschwitz at the time. Later on, after the war, he found out that his half-sister, his father, and his aunt and uncle were all deported at that same time and had been killed in Auschwitz. So most of the men who I've interviewed will tell you, "Hey, I have nothing to lose to tell you that I knew about Auschwitz, but I didn't at the time. I knew Jews were being persecuted. I did see a few, extermination actions, but I didn't really know what was going on." Or they chose not to believe what was going on. But most of them will tell you that they did not know about the Holocaust. And when I say the Holocaust, I mean the systematic extermination of Jews under Hitler. And the most telling fact to prove this is the story of half-Jews and organization Tote, the OT forced labor camps of 1944. By 1942, tens of thousands of half-Jews had been dismissed from the military. And most of them went home, and ironically, they found work, or they studied. And this is also an irony of history, because while their Aryan comrades had the honor to go to Russia and get slaughtered, these men were relatively safe at home. Yes, they did have the Allied bombings, but as a group, they survived at a higher average than their Aryan counterparts.
Did they have to submit to the racial laws and not go to movies and not shop in public stores except on certain days of the week and so on?
Many of them, they had special cards at the universities, the yellow cards instead of the brown cards. Many of them were worried about dating women because of racial defilement. Many of them had lesser portions from the rations than other families did. And to get back to the question about the Holocaust, by 1944, Hitler had decided to use this valuable pool of manpower, and he deported them to these forced labor camps, the OT forced labor camps. Now, had the half-Jews known about the camps, Auschwitz, and the Holocaust. Why did they report to their own OT deportation stations? The vast majority of these men received their notices from the Gestapo, which gave them a few days, if not weeks, so they had a chance to escape. But most of them still reported when called. And this indicates to me that they did not know, because had they known, one would think they would have done everything they could have to have gone into hiding, obtained false documents, or even tried to escape to Switzerland or Sweden, tried their luck no matter what the cost.
Well, I know this raises a very important question. It raises a very important question about a book that got a lot of attention in the country and in the world a few years ago, Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's Hitler's Willing Executioners, where he says that Germans back away from the front inevitably had knowledge of the exterminations, but they had by now been shifted through the propaganda from eliminationist anti-Semitism, get the Jews out of Europe, send them to Madagascar or whatever. They've been shifted from that to, quote, exterminationist anti-Semitism. The only answer to the Judenfrage, the Jewish problem, is kill the Jews. And that they basically accepted what they heard from soldiers returning from the Eastern Front, that they were engaged in extermination operations off in the East, and that was okay with Germany generally. Thus, Germans were complicit, if only by their passivity and their acceptance of the reality of what was happening on the Eastern Front. Now, that what you find with these Jewish soldiers who were out on the Eastern Front and still say they didn't really know about it calls into question, I suppose, Goldhagen's characterization of German complicity generally.
You know, most historians do not agree with Goldhagen, and his book is not utilized in historical circles. It's not credible historical research, according to many historians.
Well, it got a very positive reception, as you know, in Germany.
It's very emotional. Yeah, you know, it's very easy to have a black and white view of history. Yeah. All Germans are Nazis. All Jews were victims, and my research shows that that's not the case. You know, Professor Kershaw, renowned historian from
Ian Kershaw,
Ian Kershaw,
who was on this program when his last book appeared.
A brilliant historian, and he describes how complicated it was to know about the Third Reich. He writes, during the war years, interest in the Jewish question declined further. The deportation passed off apparently little heeded by the population. The German people seem to have asked little and cared less about the fate of the Jews. The war, its worries and deprivations dominated public opinion. The Jews were out of sight and out of mind. Now, knowledge of shootings and atrocities were widespread, and rumors about extermination were common. But details about the extermination process, the gassing, systematic gassing program, appear, however, according to Kershaw, to have been largely unknown.
Well, I had a little bit of a quarrel with Ian Kershaw on that very subject, because though he's extremely authoritative as a great historian, but as one reasons it, there were German soldiers, whether working in the extermination camps or not, who knew of those extermination camps, and they either get killed or they go home on furlough sooner or later. And when they go home on furlough, they talk about what they've been seeing. Maybe some don't, but most of them do. Most of them submit to the grilling they get from their parents and their siblings and their relatives back home. That would have spread the word about what was happening at Sobibor, Treblinka, Auschwitz by 1943-44.
Yeah, you would think so. Many of these men, you know, if they heard about these camps, they heard about it in a, you know, usually a context where they're on the front. They're coming back on a, you know, on the train to visit their relatives, and they may hear it from other people who are on leave or from some SS officers. So there's a big difference of hearing it and understanding what you're hearing. Then there's even a bigger difference of witnessing it. And many of these people, yeah, they may have heard about, you know, these camps or that Jews were being sent off and so on, but they didn't understand what that really meant. And many of them had not witnessed it, and even those who witnessed it didn't really understand what they were seeing. And the ones who lived there in the camps, is where you really began with knowledge, and that was a very tiny percentage of the population.
Yeah, and a number of them, in fact, were not Germans, but were from the Baltic states.
Yeah,
and Ukrainians.
The Nazis used other people to do their dirty work. So, you know, the men that I've documented, many of them, they denied the signs. Many of them heard about, you know, certain atrocities, but they didn't believe them, and they thought they were isolated.
Well, of course, deny is the proper verb there, because, in fact, the mechanism of denial has to be activated to some extent if you're facing that degree of Schrecklichkeit. If there's that much horror and that much vile crime by the state in which you live, I think you have to deny it, or you might go a little bit mad, or you might feel incredibly begrimed and befouled.
Yeah, you know, you would think so, but from my experience with the people I've documented, many of them, after the war, are looking for their families. And you would think that had they known that when 80-year-old grandma had been deported, that she had been deported directly to her death, you know, there was no denying the fact that she had died. Also, many of these men during the war years, you know, go to the camps. They're trying to find their relatives. They don't think that the inevitable happened. And many of the men who were deported to the forced labor camps, they never came to the idea that their relatives who had been deported before them.
What was the intention of the Nazi hierarchy about what to do with these guys after they had won the war and the war was over?
Oh, yeah. Had Germany prolonged the war, God forbid, had Hitler won it, half Jews would have shared the fate of the full Jews. And
they were all to be exterminated, ultimately.
Yes. Yeah, once you exterminate their parents, you can't have their kids running around. And also, they were creating so many difficulties for the Nazis. And with quarter Jews, they would have been selectively sterilized and in some cases also exterminated, especially if they looked particularly Jewish. And that was a sad fate that awaited Michelin veterans. In the end, their service would not have been honored, just like the Jewish World War I veterans, you know, service was not honored.
So they were saved by Germany's defeat.
Absolutely, yeah. It was very timely for them, because had it gone on for a few more months, a few more years, most of the men who I have interviewed would not be here today.
Fascinating. Horrifying and fascinating. We pause for the usual reasons, a quick commercial or two, and then we're going to be taking the quick mid-program newscast and then directly back to Brian Mark Rigg, drawing from his book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. And it is time to invite telephone calls. The lines are open right now. The number, as ever, is 591-7200, 591-7200. If you want to put a question to Brian Mark Rigg, do by all means give us a call. There are in this town, particularly in some of the suburbs like Skokie, a number of German Jews from that period. Most of them are somewhat on the elderly side now, but they retain considerable interest in these matters, and it would be a great boon for us if we were to hear from some German Jews, particularly those who managed to get through the war years in Germany, as some did. On the civilian side. 591-7200. If you're listening on the internet anyplace else in the world and want to join us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com, or 591-7200. Onto the phones in about 10 minutes. There's a leftover matter. You deal with it in the book, just as others have dealt with this question before. Ian Kershaw deals with it in his two-volume history of of Hitler and the Nazi period. And Ron Rosenbaum, whom we mentioned privately in his book Explaining Hitler, deals with it. It's the basic question of whether at the peak of all this dreadful exterminationist anti-Semitism that was the Nazi racialist philosophy, a philosophy enacted in the great Holocaust genocide, at the top of all of this was a quarter Jew.
Oh yeah, the
Hitler had a Jewish
A
Jewish
around
grandfather.
That, Hitler had a Jewish grandfather. This is the fact, and I quote you know, Fritz Redlich from Yale University, a very well-known psychiatrist there and a brilliant doctor, and he basically did a study on Hitler and it basically did a diagnosis of him. And in his book, he says, you know, Hitler, whether he had a Jewish past or not, we don't know. It could have happened, but we don't know. But one thing is for certain, he was scared that he had a Jewish past.
Exactly.
And this drove him.
Well, let's just quickly review the background facts about his origins. This goes back to his paternal grandmother.
That's correct. She supposedly was working in a home as a maid, was, I think, 42 at the time.
In a Jewish home.
Supposedly a Jewish home. Was never been married, single, 42, and suddenly she becomes pregnant. And
this is a rich Jewish family in Graz, Austria.
Yes. There's another Gestapo report saying that it was a Rothschild home in Vienna. But the Hans Frank, Hitler's lawyer, who later inspected this story, this is the story he gave at the Nuremberg trials and after the war. And he said that when Hitler had him go down there to inspect this, he found that Hitler's grandmother was working in a Jewish home in Graz, suddenly becomes pregnant, and that the Jewish family supports Hitler's grandfather and grandmother, Hitler's father and grandmother for several years until the boy, you know, comes of age. And basically the Austrian laws back then said once the boy out of wedlock comes to age, he's no longer, under the law to be supported by his natural father. And so Frank said, yeah, probably Hitler was a quarter Jew, but there's no facts to support Frank's story.
But you quote Fritz Redlich, whom I used to know, by the way, when I was a very young assistant professor at Yale, and he was pretty young in those days too. You quote Redlich as saying that probably, whether he was or wasn't a quarter Jew, he was preoccupied with it and felt he might be.
Oh, yeah,
How
yeah.
then does that relate? It comes down to individual psychopathology, I suppose. How does that relate to what he did to the Jews of the world?
Well, in 1935, when the Nuremberg Laws came out, Hitler had written in there that no Aryan chambermaid under the age of 45 could work in a Jewish home. He also, had a cemetery where a lot of his relatives were buried, turned into an artillery field, just obliterated. And there's debate about whether the Russians did that or the German or Hitler did, but a lot of people believe Hitler did it. Also, he was, he told supposedly Speer, Albert Speer, his armaments minister, and then also one of his superiors in World War I, that he, thought that he might have the Jewish past, and he was haunted by this. So there's many stories about this that, continually come up that show that Hitler was haunted by this demon, and it really drove him, some people say, psychologists especially, to hate the Jews,
You discovered in your own life, when you became a young adult, you discovered that you are what, one-eighth Jewish yourself?
Yeah, it's from my five generations back that I found. When I was 21, I went over to Germany, and I wanted to learn the language of my ancestors and also research on my family's
You
background.
thought your family was just German.
Yeah, I thought they were, German Christians. And as I researched, I found that there is a segment of my German family that were of Jewish descent. And I never knew this before. So that was very shocking to me because I grew up in a very Bible Belt oriented, society in Texas. And so afterwards, I wanted to know more what this meant. Who's a Jew? What is Judaism? And so I started exploring those roots. I went to a yeshiva in Jerusalem, did a volunteer time in a Marva unit in the Israeli army, learned a little Hebrew, and wanted to learn about that aspect of my ancestry as well. So yes, I am a so-called also Mischling. We all
Yes,
are.
yes. But you would never, even if you were somehow had become a young Nazi, you wouldn't have, and knowing that you were a Mischling, you would not have had anything to do with a campaign to exterminate the Jews. How could Hitler have done that? He knew this from the beginning. He knew this when he was probably still a kid in Graz, Austria. He knew it when he was hanging around in Vienna before the war, and then in Munich after the war. He knew that he was possibly, at least he was preoccupied with the possibility that there was a touch of Jewish, of the Jewish gene pool, or a touch of the Jew in his gene pool. How could he have gone forward with that kind of anti-Semitism?
Well, how can you explain hate? I mean, he was driven by an incredible hatred. And where that came from, some people say he was infected by a Jewish prostitute and had syphilis. Some people say that because the Jewish doctor who took care of his mother didn't do a good enough job and his mother died, he hated the Jews. Others say because his grandmother was taken advantage by this rich Jewish family and impregnated. And he hated his father, also. So, I mean, there's so many things in Hitler's background that one could point to for his hatred. But how can we explain hate? I mean, Hitler was driven by an incredible hatred, and it manifested itself, unfortunately, in what we call today, the Holocaust, 6 million Jews
Of
that
course,
died.
Alan Bullock, I'm sure you've read Lord Bullock, he says,
Incredible historian.
and he says of Hitler that probably when he first got into anti-Semitism, it was merely a matter of using what was around. It was done cynically. He had no particular feelings about the Jews, but that sold. That was a line that worked very well in Munich in those immediate post-war years. And so he wanted to rise in the world and be a leader, and that's the way he vaulted into prominence with his outrageous anti-Semitism. Only later did he come to sort of believe what he'd been saying for some time.
Yes, and there's a lot of a truth to that. I believe had the Jews not been there, let's say the Jews had never been in
He
existence,
would
and
have
Hitler
found
comes
something
over, he
else.
would have found somebody else
Yeah.
to be his opponent. He needed somebody to attack, to help people focus on, to raise their emotions and say, hey, these are the people who are responsible for Germany's misfortune.
There's one other guy we've got to talk about, if only briefly, before we stop for some commercials and then go to the phones. If
Please.
it comes to secret Jewish partial origin, partial Jewish origin, the executive officer of the Holocaust itself was Reinhard Heydrich. Heinrich Himmler, who ran the SS, was in charge of it all,
mm-hmm.
under Hitler's supervision and reporting constantly to Hitler. But the man who really carried it all through is the second in command of the SS,
mm-hmm.
Namely Reinhard Heydrich.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I read this earlier in some other sources, and you also deal with it here. The possibility is that he may have been a Mischling, a half-Jew.
Yeah, you know, here again, like with Hitler, the only facts that we have about Heydrich is that he probably had a lot of fear that he was of Jewish descent. Whether he was or not, we don't know until more documents come to light. But he continually was plagued by this. People in his town thought his father, Bruno Heydrich, was Jewish. Many people continually called him the Blonde Moses. And, you know, a lot of the SS continually, you know, talked about him being Jewish. Hitler and Himmler probably, you know, according to Himmler's masseuse, Kirsten, he says after the war that Himmler told him several times that they knew that Heydrich was of Jewish descent, and they used this against him to control him. They knew they would have a loyal individual because they gave him some...
You know, it sounds a little bit more credible in the Heydrich case than it does in the Hitler case.
Yeah, there's a lot of people saying that there's more circumstantial evidence out there pointing to Heydrich's Jewish past than Hitler.
He's a fascinating, horrifying character, Heydrich is.
He's incredibly evil.
Yeah.
And he's the mastermind. A lot of people say he's the mastermind of the Holocaust.
People know these days of the Wannsee Conference,
yes,
which was where the orders were given to all sorts of functionaries. The Holocaust, the extermination operation was already underway, but this was sort of straightening it all out. In fact, the great preoccupation they had at that conference was what you do about the Mischlinge.
Yeah. This Wannsee
Conference... But he ran the conference, didn't
yes.
he?
Yes. Heydrich was ahead of this conference. He brought a whole bunch of Nazi dignitaries there. And although there had been some gassing programs going on before, basically this conference was to decide, okay, who is Jewish enough to be exterminated, and how do we go about doing it? And basically said, okay, we need to get rid of the Jews, systematically exterminate them, get them on the train, send them to the death camps, and let's gas them, get rid of them. But the debate about who was Jewish enough was continually come back to during this conference. And they were saying, hey, half-Jews and quarter-Jews in Germany, because, you know, half-Jews and quarter-Jews in Russia and Poland, they were Jewish, and they were exterminated along with the full Jews. But in Germany, they didn't know what to do with these people. And so they basically said, okay, after the war, we'll decide. Heydrich wanted to exterminate half-Jews and quarter-Jews. He said, hey, they, you know, anybody with any Jewish descent is dangerous. We need to get rid of it, get rid of all Jewish blood in our, society. But a lot of people said, hey, we would have so many problems with their Aryan relatives. Many of them are high-ranking officers. We can't do it. Not yet, at least. And so this was, you know, a large part of the conference was devoted to this subject matter.
At Wannsee, they drew up a list of all the Jews in the world, mm-hmm. With estimates of how many were in various countries, including the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they made clear that after they won the war, their ultimate intention was to make not only Germany Judenrein, clean of Jews, but the world.
Yeah, they were upset. The Nazi hierarchy, especially Hitler, was obsessed with this racial ideology. And he truly believed that only he could discern a person's true racial makeup. That's mm-hmm. why he gave the exemptions. But he also truly believed that, by and large, the sooner we get rid of the Jews, the better for the world, mm-hmm. and especially better for the Aryan race. You know,
there's a last. There's so much that's so fascinating in your book, and we've done the outline of it. We haven't got to all the detail. Tell the story about the coming of the Lubavitcher Hasidim to the United States.
The sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Joseph Schneerson. He was in Poland when Germany invaded Poland in 1939, and thousands of worried Lubavitchers in Canada and America started writing the government.
Can I ask you for a moment to do a little sidebar and explain what the Lubavitchers are?
Oh, the Lubavitcher is an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect.
A Hasidic sect.
Yeah, Hasidic sect, very religious. And they're probably the biggest Orthodox Jewish community in the world then and mm-hmm. today. And so in 1939, the Rebbe, you can have only one Rebbe. There's many rabbis, but only one Rebbe. Like in the Catholic tradition, there's only one pope, but many priests. And so the Rebbe, he's divine. He's respected by all in the Lubavitch community as being the figurehead of, you know, for the community, and also the spokesman for the community, and also the intercessor between the community and God. And so when he was in Poland in 1939, when Germany invaded, the Lubavitchers here in America and Canada were just worried sick and writing letters, you know, thousands of them to the government. And many of these letters actually got to Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, and he took them to Roosevelt and also many other people in the government. And they thought, hey, we have a big voting population here. We got to take this seriously. And Pell had contact with Voltaire, who was Goering's state secretary in the four-year plan. And Voltaire had told him earlier that if there was any Jew in Germany that he wanted to save, he would help him out. So Pell, on orders from Cordell Hull and many others, you know, Wagner and, you know, Brandeis and a lot of other people were involved with this case. He gets in touch with Voltaire. Voltaire then gets in touch with Canaris, who's head of the Secret Service in Germany.
Admiral Canaris,
who's in charge of the Abwehr. And Canaris then orders a half-Jew, Ernst Bloch, Major Ernst Bloch, and he says, go find the Rebbe, rescue him, and get him back to Berlin, and give him over to the Latvian diplomats, because he's a Latvian citizen. And so this guy, who's a half-Jew, has a few other Mischling soldiers under him, and they go to Poland, and they have, in uniform, they're going around talking to these ultra-Orthodox Jews, trying to convince them that they're there to help them, you know, rescue the Rebbe. Eventually, they're able to convince the Lubavitchers. And they go through all these SS checkpoints. The Major Bloch, he pretends that these are his prisoners, and he yells at the Jews in front of the SS, but he gets them through the blockades, and he gets them finally to Berlin, turns over the Rebbe to the Latvian diplomats. They take him to Latvia. From Latvia, he gets to Sweden. From Sweden, he gets to Brooklyn, New York, where the headquarters of Lubavitch is today.
And he spends the next 50 years there.
Yeah. Well, no, this is the sixth.
His son-in-law.
He lasted, I think, five more years. He died in 1950.
His son-in-law is Menachem Mendel Schneerson.
Mendelssohn, that's correct. And he married his daughter.
But he took the family name.
He had the same name, but Joseph's name was at the end, S-O-H-N, and Menachem was S-O-N. So it was the same name and no relation.
Yeah. Fascinating. We will be going to the phones. There's some space available on the board. If you want to call us, now's the time to do so. 591-7200 for your questions and or comments to Brian Mark Rigg, author of Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, The Untold Story of Nazi Racial Laws and Men of Jewish Descent in the German Military. University of Kansas Press are the publishers, and we'll be right on to your contributions, whether by phone or by email, after these words. And we will go directly to the telephones for your questions and comments to Brian Mark Rigg. 591-7200, at the moment all the lines are taken. If you're trying to reach us and not getting through, your proper strategy is to call again after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And here is the first potential prior caller. Good evening.
Hi, sir. How are you?
All right.
Thank you for the discussion. It's actually extremely informative. I'm an active duty Air Force officer, and one of the things that we talked about in our basic training is how we take an oath to the United States Constitution, but in Nazi Germany, the Wehrmacht ended up taking an oath to Hitler. And I was wondering if there was any research done on if these Jewish soldiers ended up having to take an oath to Hitler and how they felt about it at the time.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your question, and also thank you for your service to our country. Most of these men that I've documented, in fact, the vast majority, they all had to take an oath to Hitler. And when asked about how they felt about the oath, they said, hey, you know, he was a commander-in-chief of the army, he was head of the nation. We didn't think anything was strange about giving the oath, and we didn't take it that seriously. Because you hear after the war, a lot of times the high-ranking German officer said, you know, the reason why I was loyal to Hitler and the regime was because I gave an oath. But many of these men, the oath did not play much of a role in their lives. And also many of the men tell me that because they were in a long line of other soldiers who were giving the oath, sometimes they didn't, you know, say the words. Or when it came to, say, Adolf Hitler, they didn't say anything, and they thought that would somehow jinx it for them. You know, many of these guys were 17, 18, 19 years old, so that was the logic that they used at the time. But most of these men all gave an oath to Hitler.
Wow. Well, fascinating. Wonderful, wonderful work and great discussion. I've ended up driving in my car for the last 45 minutes just to hear it. So thank you.
We thank you, sir.
Right,
good night. And to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I have a question about the treatment of veterans of the Great War, which probably pertains nonetheless to the discussion here. Your guest should, I think, be familiar with something colloquially known as the Hindenburg Cross. Issued, actually, it was instituted before Hindenburg's death. Most of them weren't given out until after Hindenburg's death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I understand it, the Hitlerjugend were ordered to salute anyone wearing a Hindenburg cross as they were, you know, walking down the street or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, a good many Jews, you know, would have earned the Hindenburg cross, since this medal was given to all survivors of the Great War, who's you know, with honorable discharges, so to speak.
Yeah, that's correct.
So you would have had, it seems to me, the ironic situation of Hitlerjugend saluting Jewish war veterans insofar as they were walking around wearing the Hindenburg Cross. And I'm wondering, A, if he actually knows of any specific instances of this sort of thing, or B, beyond that, what that might say about the general. In other words, would there have been anything to prevent that from happening? In other words, at what point did they start having to wear yellow stars, that sort of thing?
Yeah, thank you for your question. I have not documented any particular case of a Jewish veteran being saluted by Hitler Youth, although many of these, you know, there was 100,000 German Jews who served in the German armed forces during World War I. 12,000 of them died. A few thousand of them became officers. Many of them were highly decorated. And many of these men, even before they got the Hindenburg Award in 1934, they were, you know, walking around town with their ribbons or even sometimes their medals, their iron crosses and so on. And there was a high respect for the military. And unfortunately, many of these veterans, they thought, because of my service in World War I, they're not going to hurt me. They're not going to hurt my family. And unfortunately, they were sadly mistaken. And many of these men were deported off to the camps wearing their iron crosses and so on.
These would have been full Jews.
These were the full Jews, yeah. 100,000 full German Jews served in the German armed forces during World War II. More German Jews served in the German military during World War I, than in all Israeli, more German Jews died in World War I than in all Israeli conflicts from 1948 to 1982. The German Jews were very patriotic, and they were highly respected until Hitler came into power, and then all of a sudden all these honors that they had were not honored anymore. And most German Jews started having to wear the star in 40, 41. Most of them 41. That's when it was forced on them.
Our thanks to that caller, and quickly on to another. 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, good evening. Well, I was just over in Prague about a week or two ago during the floods. 10 years ago, I had a chance to visit Terezin, and I was hoping to go back, but due to the flooding situations, the support staff only had 2 hours to evacuate it. What I was curious to know, and it's hard to get information on, I understand there's a tremendous amount of archival and documents there that were, flooded and damaged, and I was curious to know how much of that is at risk of being lost, and how much are we, how much of the history there are we are we worried about losing?
You're speaking of Theresienstadt?
Yeah.
The concentration camp? I do not know how much of the archive there has been damaged, so I sorry for my ignorance. I cannot comment on that. I would assume that most of the documents were taken out before the flood, but it happened very quickly, and there might have been some documents that were lost. I hope not.
Theresienstadt was a curious place. It was sort of the show camp, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's great. They actually brought in the Red Cross to show them that they were treating the Jews wonderfully, that they were giving the Jewish a city. It was all a farce, because if you had gone to the sinks and tried to turn them on, the water would not have run. And it was a camp for a lot of German Jews, and it was a holding camp for elderly Jews. But a lot of them, especially toward the end of the war, were starting to be shipped off en masse to Auschwitz.
It was a sort of Potemkin village.
Yes.
A showpiece.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They had a quite amazing museum there. I just hope that those artifacts and things. I know there was also, actually, at the time, there was a display for a surrealist prisoner of war that was there. And what's ironic about it is his work that was on display there has all been washed away in the floods.
Oh.
And I just hope that there were some pretty dramatic pictures I saw there of, like you talked about, they had prisoners there sketching things. And when the Red Cross, and when they aren't under German supervision, they'd quickly sketch the real what was going on and pass it to the Red Cross, and some of the things survived. And some of those works are just amazing, and I just can't imagine what would happen if we lost it.
Yeah, I hope nothing got lost either.
Sir, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You've been in and around Germany a lot. How much time have you put in there? 5 or 6 years, on and off?
Well, yeah, on and off, I've probably put altogether about 4.5, 5 years of.
What's your observation about the level of anti-Semitism in contemporary Germany?
I would say it's higher here in America than it is in Germany. A lot of people aren't allowed to voice this because of the history. Now with the conflict in Israel, people are feeling a little bit more liberated to be able to talk negatively about the Jews and what they think about Israeli policy. But many of them, for several decades, you couldn't say anything about Israeli politics for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic. So there was a fear of saying anything that would be construed of as anti-Semitic.
And what impression do you have of Jewish community life in Germany?
Well, most of the German Jews who I met were actually Russian Jews.
Yeah.
Bubis, who was the leader of German Jewry for several years, he got the government to support a lot of programs of bringing persecuted Russian Jews to Germany to rebuild the Jewish community there. So, like when I was in Freiburg, I would say 80%, 85% of the Jewish community there were Russian Jews, and a few were survivors, and a few others were converts, German converts, mm-hmm. who, because of the Holocaust, they felt the need to convert to Judaism. But most of the Jewish community, as it was in the 20s and 30s, is, of course, forever gone and yeah. disappeared.
One book that I found particularly informative and moving was the one by the fellow in Dresden.
Viktor Klemperer.
Viktor Klemperer. Mm-hmm. Because he's a full Jew, but Christianized, mm-hmm. and married to a German Christian woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes it through the whole war only. And you get a day-by-day account of all the insults, all the restrictions, all the dehumanizing mm-hmm. impositions upon him. But he's, in a way, saved by the fact that he's married to that mm-hmm. to that Aryan, in quotes, woman.
Mm-hmm.
That the very last, he does get an order to report for being shipped east. And he's got 2 or 3 days to pull his stuff together before he reports, and the bombing of Dresden occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife get out. They run westward and run into the American zone.
Yeah. Many of the men who I've documented who were half Jews or quarter Jews, they said, you know, just as long as my parents stayed married, or my grandparents,
mm-hmm.
the Jewish partner was protected. As soon as they divorced, and many of these people did divorce, a lot of times because the Gestapo forced them to, then they lost the protection of the Aryan partner, the quote-unquote Aryan partner. And then toward the end of the war, these mixed marriages would no longer been protected, and these people would have then eventually been deported. But that did delay their deportation for several years.
I searched the Internet today to see who's reacting in what way to your book, and I found at least two revisionist organizations. They say they're revisionist, and that means they don't believe the Holocaust occurred, not the way it was reported, mm-hmm. And they're revising history to make it more accurate. But they also have a very strong anti-Semitic undertone,
mm-hmm.
and that's really what those organizations are about. But they are, at least one of them, is using your book as proof that the Holocaust, in the form that we think it occurred, never occurred.
Well, it shows that these idiots have not read my book, because in my book I, you know, flatly state that, hey, you know, 6 million people did die, 6 million Jews did die, the Holocaust did happen, Hitler did order it. So it shows that these people have not read my book. And, you know, anybody who denies the Holocaust, they're either, you know, incredibly evil or stupid.
Well, they haven't read the book, because they say, well, namely Riggs, says 150,000 Jews served, and we discover from his book that Hitler gave Deutsche Blutigkeitserklärungen to every one of them.
Yeah.
He declared them all to be, therefore it's clear that they really accepted lots of Jews, at least half Jews, and they weren't that anti-Semitic.
Yeah, that's absolutely nonsense. Anybody who reads my book will see that I don't know where he got that idea.
From the flyleaf.
Yeah, well, the flyleaf, and also that you know, I don't say in the flyleaf that Hitler gave all these people exemptions. Hitler knew about the policies that allowed these people to serve. But
not many got those exemptions, whether from Hitler or from anybody else.
No, according to Hitler's state secretary, Lammers, he said that after the war, he said that Hitler gave thousands. And I concur with this assessment, especially when one knows that Hitler had decreed that any Mischling soldier who had been severely wounded in combat was to be retroactively declared Aryan to the day of his injury. And also Hitler had said that any Mischling soldier who had died in combat was to be posthumously declared mm-hmm. an Aryan. Hitler had said he did not want to be ungrateful to Mischling soldiers who had shed blood for the Third Reich, showing again his crazy way of looking at these racial laws and the bankruptcy of these racial laws, because basically he was the ultimate authority, not any
Correct.
Scientific proofs.
Time to pause for another round of commercials, then directly back to the phones. 591-7200, and the email has infinite capacity if you want to email us from wherever you are. The email address, extension 720 as one word, at tribune.com. And quickly back to Brian Mark Rigg, author of Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. University of Kansas Press is the publisher, and this is utterly readable and fascinating on every page. It's horrifying on some of the pages, to be sure.
Absolutely.
591-7200 as we go to the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. Very interesting topic this evening. I'm rereading William Shirer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, where some of his early contacts, like Putsch and the first party that he joined was the Pan-German Party, wasn't it, with Georg Ritter von Schirnerer?
Yeah, you're speaking of Hitler now.
Of Hitler,
yeah,
yes.
And Shirer.
And wasn't von Schirnerer, wasn't he an anti-Semite?
Yes, and Hitler quickly took over the power of the party, the German Workers'
Right, but I'm just
party.
Wondering, in terms of the depth of his, we were saying earlier about where this came from, if it was inherent because of his parental background or lineage, or for some other reason. Mm-hmm. Would it not have been more logical, as Shirer puts it in his book, that some of these things were impressed upon him in Vienna in his earlier years?
Well, I think that, you know, as far as Hitler's anti-Semitism, there are so many things you can point to as a source of it. I mean, during his Vienna years, if he was mistreated by someone, or that's where, you know, Vienna... anti-Semitism, you asked me earlier, Milt, about anti-Semitism in Germany. I didn't experience anti-Semitism in Germany. I experienced it in Austria. That was a seatbed of anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. especially
that's
when Hitler...
Was, yeah.
Yeah, as Hitler, when Hitler was there, it was especially very anti-Semitic. And so, you know, Hitler picked up some anti-Semitism there. He picked it up during the war and after the war. I mean, there's really not one time period that people can point to where Hitler picked it up. I don't think it was forced upon him. Hitler came to this on his own. And he was a passionate believer in it, and it became his religion.
But, you know, in terms of what Hitler said in Mein Kampf, mm-hmm. in terms of the spiritual and physical tyranny, this is what holds people in at bay. This is what you use against your adversaries, because eventually they can no longer fight against it. And, again, earlier you were saying about how could some of these people report to their own stations? Well, this was something that as a terror weapon, they were already given up.
Well, you know, you do point out something that's very important to note, and that is that many of these men, you know, when you ask them, why did you report to your own deportation stations? You know, many of them say, hey, you know, I didn't have any choice, and if I didn't report, maybe they would have hurt my family. The fear factor. I mean, we don't know what it's like to live under a totalitarian regime,
right.
Especially the Third Reich. And these people lived under a lot of fear, and the psychological toll that it cost them is something that we cannot imagine today in our free, you know, very wonderful society that's based on freedom.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thanks.
And we must move rather quickly. Here's an email that I think will interest you. I don't know enough U.S. history to know the extent to which this is true, but there were apparently some black soldiers in the Confederate Army during our Civil War. Mm-hmm. I do know that many American Indians served as Army scouts in the 19th century. The stakes probably weren't as high for them as for German Jews, but what they were doing was similar.
Yes, there are some parallels in history. The Koreans who were forced to serve in the Japanese military during World War II, also African Americans who served in the Confederacy during the Civil War. Some historians put the number as high as 40,000 African Americans served. And many of these men, some of them were slave owners themselves, and they wanted to preserve a society that they had profited from.
Blacks owning
yes.
black slaves.
Yeah. Some of them were actually slaves of officers who were then brought into the war. Some of them were brought in as servants. And so on, and they served in that capacity in the Confederacy. But many of these men, while they were serving, their families were not being systematically exterminated. Yes, they were experiencing persecution. So there is parallels here that they were serving in the armed forces that actually looked down upon their people, you know, from an ethnic point of view. But nonetheless, it wasn't as horrifying as the ones in Germany, you know, the example of the Mischling and the Jews in Germany. And also, what's interesting about the history that I've documented is that for decades before Hitler came into power, these people were German citizens. They had served in the German armed forces as, as equal citizens, and it was taken away from them. Whereas in the Confederacy, many of these men, they, the free blacks who owned black slaves, they had moved up in society, and they maintained that position.
No.
And many of the slaves, they had not had freedom before. Of course, when they were in Africa, yes. But when they were brought over to the States, they were slaves, and they did not have a privileged, status in their society before. And that was what's shocking about my history as well, is that many of these men, they were demoted, so to speak, in society. And then their relatives were systematically exterminated.
Am I right in this? I'm just working in memory. About half of the Jews who were living in Germany at the time the Nazis came to power ultimately get out of Germany before the war.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The ones who were left are in a way less Jewish than the ones who, by virtue of their strong Jewish identity, decide to get out.
Well, many of the ones that were left didn't have the connections, didn't have the money to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them were more optimistic. They didn't think it was going to get as bad. Many of them had been a product of the Weimar Republic in that every few months, or at the longest amount of time, maybe a year, there's a new political party. So they didn't think Hitler was going to last very long. And then when it was too late, they couldn't get out. So, many of the people who recognized the danger in, 33 to 35, 36, they were able to get out. Then when you start getting in 38, 39, and in 40, it was very difficult.
And, of course, there were more Mischlinge, more attenuated Jews who were kind of gone beyond Jewish identity.
Oh, yeah. Many of these the half-Jews and quarter-Jews, most of them were brought up as Christians.
Sure.
Because according to the Nazi laws, if you practiced Judaism, you were a Jew. So most of the Mischlinge who had practiced Judaism, they were in the same category as the full Jews, and many of them immigrated. But most of the Christian Mischlinge, they stayed in the society. They felt German. They didn't think they were going to be as affected as they were.
We go back to the phones, and here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, and I appreciate you taking my call. My question essentially revolves around one of the concepts that was sort of put forth in the introduction to the show this evening on the website, and sort of has been touched on a little bit, and I sort of wanted to get the author's take, and that's regarding sort of the complacency of the Wehrmacht as a whole in sort of the Holocaust and extermination of European and Russian Jewry. My question sort of stems from the notion that it's obviously goes without saying, has been said before, and historical evidence proves the Holocaust definitely occurred. 6 million Jews were exterminated. Definitely there's Wehrmacht and other Heer units that were responsible for war crimes and even participated in some of the actions resulting in the murder of Jews. But one of the things that I found in my own research, I've been researching this topic for 10 to 15 years myself, and have gone through countless letters from the period, from German soldiers and veteran accounts and unit histories and things of the sort, archival work, and I actually find that unlike Omar Bartov and Gold Hagen, and there's a show that is circulating, was originally in Hamburg and I believe is coming to the U.S. now, that sort of touches on this new topic of not just the SS and the Nazi extermination of Jewry, but the general military's complacency in that. And so my question sort of is, what is your general feel on that topic?
Thank you for your question. Your name?
My name's Jason.
Jason, yeah, thank you for your question. The Wehrmacht, yeah, without the Wehrmacht, the Holocaust could not have happened. That is very clear. And there's some men that I have talked to who said that their units were ordered to go, shoot Jews, and they were able to go to the commanders and say, hey, I don't want to participate in this, or they were able to find a comrade who would take their position on the shooting squad. They're very rare. I'm right now, three names come to mind out of over the 1,000 people who I've documented. So the Wehrmacht in the higher echelons, like the General von Manstein and, von Bock and von Rundstedt, they knew about what was going on in the Einsatz, grouping and so on.
Oh, absolutely.
And, they just followed orders. This is their take. They followed orders. This is something that Hitler had ordered. The SS were behind their lines. They focused on their, their military duties, and they really didn't care. There is a lot of complacency. Some of them were anti-Semitic, and they thought, okay, the Eastern Jews are dangerous, and who cares if they get killed? But they're not going to hurt the German Jews. Some of these generals rationalized. Others, they didn't care. They were soldiers. Okay, that's the SS business. It's nasty. but we're going to focus on winning the war. Others disagreed with it, and they wrote the government directly and said, Hitler, we cannot do this because it's going to hurt the morale of the troops. It's also going to prevent us from getting the support of the societies that we are dominating now. But they were a rare minority. So you're absolutely right.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We have to move rather quickly. A last round of commercials awaits, and then we'll be back. 591-7200. Before we go back to the phones, I really must ask you, share with us, if only briefly and in a thumbnail sketch, one or two of the people that you came to know and the shape of their lives.
Well, one person that comes to mind immediately is Lickwitz, and I found his name in some files in Hamburg, and so I wrote him, sent him copies of the documents, and asked him if I could meet him. And he said, sure. So when I went to meet him in Munich, we sat down, and he said, yeah, I served in the German military for 2 years, then I was discharged, and then I got the order to go to OT, forced labor camp, and I went. And after a few weeks of being there, I realized that this wasn't a forced labor camp. This was going to be my end. So I escaped, and he escaped back to Munich, lived illegally there for a few months until he was denounced, and he was sent to Dachau. So here was a man that started the war as a German soldier. He was well-respected, had good military reports, and then at the end of the war, he finds himself in Dachau, and he survives. And he is just amazing, a person of survival. There's another individual that I've documented, and his name is, and he wrote a book about it, Helmut Kruger. And, he gets discharged in 41. His brother gets discharged in 42. In 44, his mother gets deported to Theresienstadt. They go to the SS headquarters in Berlin to try to get their mother out, also to try to get drafted back into the military, thinking that that would save their mother. And they're not accepted, but it just shows the tragedy that these men, were encountered with all the time. Another guy, he actually goes to the SS headquarters. He has the ribbons of the Iron Cross first and second class that he'd earned in battle. And he says, where's my father? And the SS looked at him like, what are you doing here? I want to know where my father is. And they said, hey, if you didn't have those ribbons, showing us that you had the Iron Cross, we would send you where your father is. And unbeknownst to the man, his father had already been killed in Sachsenhausen.
Hmm.
So just countless stories of tragedy and the pain and where these men describe, where do I belong? The Jewish community after the war, I went to them and they didn't want me because I was half Jewish. My father was Jewish. I wasn't Jewish according to Halakha. I go to the German community, I'm still Jewish, and they don't really want to deal with me, especially during the Third Reich. And so these people were between two stools in more ways than one.
Some of these guys in their middle years and beyond have come to Judaism, haven't they?
Yeah, many of these men, when you go to their homes and you interview them, you look up at their bookcases, and the shelves are lined with books about Judaism, German Jewish history, Israel. Many of them are fascinated by Israel. Many of them, have gone to Israel and support Israel and even some of the reform movements there.
Of the men that you directly interviewed,
mm-hmm.
who had been in highest rank during his military career?
The highest ranking person I've documented was Field Marshal Erhard Milk, who was a half Jew, and he basically ran the Luftwaffe. He was a 5-star general.
Well, I'm talking about the people you directly interviewed.
Oh, the person I directly interviewed. The highest rank that I have documented is a major.
Who was he?
He was Heinz Rohr. And Heinz Rohr, his father, we always hear about the stormtroopers was, Third Reich as well as, with Star Wars. Well, basically the person who developed the stormtroop tactics was Heinz Rohr's father, Willy Rohr, in World War I. He's a half-Jew, a brilliant commander. And because of his father's career, Heinz Rohr and his brother were Aryanized by Hitler and brought back into the service after they had been dismissed in 1934. And they became both very high-ranking officers, majors. Not real high ranking, but for the people that I've documented, very high ranking. And they got a lot of awards, basically the equivalent of the Navy Cross for their...
Were they pushed out as well in 41, 42?
No, there was an Aryan paragraph in 1934. And many of the men who were lower ranking individuals who were in the service at the time, who were non-Aryans, this is the term the Nazis used at that time, were dismissed. And they were in this group of probably a few hundred men who were dismissed from the military because they were non-Aryans. That means they had one or more Jewish grandparents. Then they were brought back in the service in 1939 after the outbreak of the war. Many of these men who were dismissed in 1934 actually went to China and helped train Chinese troops. Many of them went and trained other soldiers like in Spain, and then also went to Italy. So they were in an advisory role, but they were not officially of the German military.
Let's work in one or two more quick calls. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Rosenberg and Mr. Markgraf. Thank you for a fascinating discussion tonight. My question is, and part of my ignorance, after the war, when the search for the leaders or officers of the concentration camps were conducted, and who conducted these atrocities, if any of these officers or leaders were to have been found to have had Jewish descent, were they treated with any other leniency or different than the full-fledged German and Nazis, due to the fact it sounds like they did what they had to do out of fear of their own losing their own lives?
Thank you for your kind words, and also thank you for your very good question. Many of these, I mean, you know, Field Marshal Milk, he was a war criminal, and he was found guilty at the Nuremberg trials. But many of the lower-ranking individuals, the grunts, so to speak, when they were put into camps or holding areas, POW camps, some of them went to the Allied, camp commanders and said, "Hey, look, I'm a half Jew. I lost my mom, to the Nazis. She committed suicide, or my grandparents were deported. We were persecuted." And some of them did receive better treatment and were able to go home earlier. But by and large, most of the men who I've documented, when they were brought into camp, especially if they were prisoner of war under the Russians, they did not get any preferential treatment. But with the Allies, especially the Americans, sometimes these men did get better treatment and then also get released. They got released a little bit earlier.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You, sir. You know, something we haven't talked about, that I'm much impressed by, is your own personal history in this regard and the methodology that you employed. You did all of this on a shoestring, essentially, didn't you?
Yeah, when I...
A shoestring and a bicycle.
Yeah, that's correct. I biked around Germany with my backpack. In my backpack, I had my tripod, I had a radio, a jam box. I always had cassettes recording next to my camera. In case my camera broke down, I had at least the audio, take on the interview. So I had the jam box, I had a tripod, I had a camera, I had my printer, my laptop computer, then I had a transformer, and I had some food and then some change of clothes. And I found that I could, basically in any German city that I went to, I could use the public transportation system with my bike. And then once I got out of a certain station, I could get to a home within 5 to 10 minutes. Sometimes I biked for several hours. One time I biked over 100 miles to get to a person's house, and thank God I did, because he died a few months later.
How did you find the people that you wanted to interview?
Well, when I first began this research, I had I didn't have much support from my professor, so they didn't think anything was there. And so I started looking into this, and after a couple of years of research, I had 7 names of living Wehrmacht veterans. So I wanted to go to Europe to interview them, so I applied for several small scholarships, and by then I got some support. I got some small support.
You say your professors didn't believe anything you said. You mean they didn't believe there was such an animal as a Jewish or part Jewish officer in the Wehrmacht?
Yeah, when I came back, I originally came into the subject matter in 1992. I was in Germany, learning the language, mm-hmm. researching my family's background, and I saw the film Europa, Europa. And before the film began, I asked, I was sitting there, and there was an old gentleman that walked in, and I went up to him with my good Texas upbringing and asked him if I could help him find a seat. And he was very appreciative, and I sat him next to me. And during the film, he interpreted the entire dialogue. And afterwards, I asked him what he thought of Europa, Europa. And for those who don't know about Europa, Europa, it's a film about a German Jew who served in the Nazi military during World War II. So after the film, I asked the gentleman next to me, his name was Peter, and I said, what do you think about it? And he said, "Wait, it's very close to my own history. Would you like to go talk?" And I said, "Sure." And we went and we talked, and he was of Jewish descent, served in the Nazi military. So I returned to Yale after this experience in that summer, and I started asking several of my professors about looking into the subject matter, and they all told me, "Hey, we've studied this for 20 or 30 years. We've never heard about this before. You should study some serious German history instead of chasing after some curious anomalies who would not add anything to our understanding of the Third Reich." And most of the professors were very nice to me. But when I found out that they had not looked into it or didn't know anybody who had looked into it, I decided, well, I'll look into it and see what I'll find. So 2 years later, I had 7 names that I had documented. And so from these 7 names, once I gained their trust, interviewed them, they said, "Hey, I have a brother, I have a cousin, I have a friend." And then it just started snowballing. And before I knew it, I had hundreds of people ready to be interviewed. And so that's how I went about doing it. So I had a Eurel pass that I went around Germany with. I had enough money that first year that I did my research for 3 months. Yale gave me enough money for 3 months, and living in park, I slept in parks sometimes, train stations. I ate bread and peanut butter. And then after about 4 or 5 months of being there, I started developing networks. I started developing good friendships. So then when I would go to Munich or Vienna or Frankfurt, I would stay with the families that I had interviewed after I gained their trust, and then I had a network going on.
I know that you're writing an autobiographical account of some aspects of your life. You should really work, you probably will work this into it. There are methodological utilities in all of this, as you've just described it, which would be of great value to young social scientists trying to do some truly innovative work.
Well, thank you, Milt.
We are, I fear, out of time. I want to congratulate you on a very important undertaking, which you've carried off brilliantly.
Thank you very much.
Jewish Soldiers by Brian Mark Rigg is published by University of Kansas Press. And a quick word about tomorrow. We're talking about the uses and abuses of public opinion polling. Mel Holly, an old friend of ours, has done a book about the original inventor of public opinion polling, and two practitioners of that art will be with us as well. That's tomorrow at 9. Until then, a cordial good night to all.